Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Matchmaker Is In. I'm Karen Webster. I'm joined today by David Evans, co-author of the book by the same name, Matchmaker. David, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me again.
And today, David and I are joined by Jeremy Allaire, the founder and CEO of Circle. Jeremy, thanks for joining us today, and happy Election Day.
Thank you. My pleasure. It's hopefully a great day.
Yeah, no, very historic day, and a day that I think a lot of us will spend a lot of time in front of the television watching the results. But until then, the polls are still open, so there's still time to do a little bit of business with respect to matchmakers, and that's what we'll talk about today. So we're here to talk about Circle, and let me put a little context around our conversation. So Circle is a social payments platform that you have said many times is all about making sending money between parties as easy as sending an email. So the question that I'd like to start with is, what problem is Circle really solving that traditional players who say they do the same thing can't?
Sure. So we, when Sean and I started the company several years ago, there were a number of things that we saw happening that led us to believe that it was going to be possible for money to work more like the way that the internet works. And that would be a tremendous opportunity for consumers and businesses ultimately, but fundamentally would create new global consumer finance companies that are built around a kind of digital native internet-based model for money. And what we really meant by that is that we've created this world where we have open networks and open software platforms that allow for incredible interoperability of communications, media sharing, content and information discovery. And these open platforms like the web and messaging platforms, like email and SMS, voice and video platforms, all these things have made tasks that in the past cost something or were sometimes complicated to do, either whether it's across the table or around the world, and it made them delightful and free and really connected the world in a deeper way. And we thought, again, there were a host of things happening that were going to make that possible with money for consumers. And so we can get into what some of those things were, but fundamentally we set out to build a new global consumer finance company. And our starting point is this focus on social payments. So we want to come up with an expression of value exchange between consumers that is a delightful experience that works anywhere in the world, works across currencies, is instant and for the consumer, free. And we think there's an opportunity to create a new kind of consumer spending account that is built around the internet as opposed to traditional brick and mortar infrastructure, and that builds on new rails that are emerging for value exchange globally. So that's at a high level what we're sort of up to. I think in a concrete sense, what does Circle say let a person do? Well, it allows them to, in a very straightforward way, connect a bank account they have, fund payments instantly. The recipients can receive those payments instantly. They can do that across the table in their own currency. They can do that across the pond or across Europe, or through the blockchain they can send value globally. And they can do that in a very, very straightforward way. If you want to do that today with, say, an existing account, it's actually quite cumbersome. There are a lot of time delays, tolls, and taxes, and it's not, I would say, a very delightful experience. And so I think we're in the early stages of social payments behavior emerging in the West in particular. It's emerged very much in China over the past, you know, 3-4 years. But I think we're in the early stages of that, and anyone who wants to offer a consumer spending account is going to need to have a way to do this, because this is sort of the new, you know, experiments in the new user interface of money as money becomes entirely digital.
And Jeremy, are you eliminating those frictions by way of technology, by way of a business model redesign, or some other some other set of processes that you're putting in place? What's the magic ingredient behind this?
It's a lot of things, and this gets to the earlier comment of there were a number of things coming together. So I think we've ended up having to build a lot of things to kind of make all this work. So we built a cloud-based, multi-currency, global, real-time settlement platform that is also able to take into account risk and credit risk and other things in every transaction. We built out essentially a new global transaction banking platform. We built out a AI-powered risk engine that allows us to make 90% of our risk and compliance decisions with machines rather than lots and lots of compliance people. We created a new consumer experience, obviously, and have been iterating on that for quite some time that really delivers on the user experience. And we've also taken advantage of new technologies like blockchain technology to allow us to create a way to do interoperable payments across currencies all around the world. And so there are a number of things that we've kind of put together to make that possible.
So Jeremy, let me get specific about the rails, because I know that when we first started talking to you about Circle, it really was blockchain and Bitcoin, but now you really seem to be payment tender agnostic with the iPhone messaging platform. There's a requirement that you have to register a debit card and money passes between individuals from their debit cards to obviously their debit accounts that underpin those. Help us understand that piece of Circle and how you think about the rails and the interoperability that you just described.
Yeah, sure. So our philosophy is we want to use the most efficient rails that we can, and efficient meaning speed and cost. Obviously, there's other factors like security or currencies or what we're legally allowed to do, et cetera. But we want to use the most efficient rail. So we use a variety of rails. So, but part of the solution here, though, is as you know, for the most part, whether it's country by country or globally, moving value with the existing rails is not instant. There are exceptions here and there, but if I want to send you $100 and you want to receive it and use it right away, it's harder to do that. Although it's improving, and you're seeing more and more products like Circle that are improving some of that. But at the end of the day, because money doesn't move instantly, at least today, with rare exception, we have to take risk. We have to essentially provide credit to people. Are you who you mm-hmm. say you are? Are you likely mm-hmm. to reverse that charge? Are you doing something illegal? A whole host of things. But when you transact, we have to, if we want to make funds available instantly, then we essentially are taking credit risk. So that's where having this risk engine that is machine learning based allows us to take credit risk to make money move instantly. So if I'm, say, in the U.S. and I send $100 to a UK mobile phone number, and that person in the UK instantly has the equivalent in pounds with essentially a 25 basis point pricing spread, which is the best exchange rate in the world for consumers, and they have pounds available to them instantly. Well, we're taking that risk. We're essentially saying we're going to eventually get this money settled with us, and we're making a judgment in real time about that. And the person on the other end obviously can take the money and run, so to speak. So that's part of what we do is we use our risk engine to make real-time credit decisions to make money move faster. Now, the nice thing about digital assets like Bitcoin is that they're bearer instruments, and so they if you have it, you have it, and it settles very quickly. So our interest with Bitcoin really from day one has always been, can this be a protocol that sits behind existing systems of money for faster settlement on a goal and an interoperability format so that I can know if I'm broadcasting dollars that someone in the Philippines can receive peso and we can settle that transaction in minutes in a very secure way and in an irreversible way. That's what our interest has been in Bitcoin from day one. And even when we introduced our first product in late 2014, it was really positioned as a P2P money transfer application. And if you go back and look at the website and all the positioning and so on, we were really focused on driving that use case. The reality was that was the only product we could make available because we were in a 2.5-year process to get licensed by every U.S. state and a 2-year-plus process to get licensed throughout the EU and the UK. And so to launch our mainstream product and the vision that we set out to offer, you know, 3 years ago, we had to do a lot of work building infrastructure and building government relationships and ultimately becoming a regulated financial institution. And only then did we actually launch a product that we started to market. That was just over a year ago. And that's grown really, really quickly. But even now, in the, you know, the case of Circle, you know, we don't expect consumers to ever want to hold Bitcoin unless you're a speculator or you have an edge case or an edgy case, I should say. What we expect, though, is that people want the benefits of a blockchain-based digital asset transfer. They want the benefit. They may not articulate it that way, but they certainly want the benefits. They want speed, low cost, security, openness, global reach. These are the same kinds of things that other internet protocols have brought. We've never also thought that, you know, there's one true way in all this, that there's one digital currency or one blockchain. It's we view this as on an innovation curve that's similar to the innovation curve of the web, and the technology standards are going to evolve dramatically in the coming years. But that model of an open network that people can plug into in a compliant manner is very attractive to us and something that we're going to continue to build on.
It sounds like you have a high ratio of lawyers to engineers.
Well, it's interesting. You know, we talk about you know, how would you think about what kind of company we are? You know, we look mostly like a software company, like a consumer internet technology company. If you look at the, you know, percentage of operating expenses or labor operating expenses that are in engineering and product related roles, it's almost half. So we have a very, very, you know, heavy focus on software and engineering. And that goes from the leadership of the company. Sean and I, we both have very strong product and technology backgrounds, but then into the P&L itself. But we're also a highly well-risk managed company. So unlike a traditional consumer internet or software company, about 25% of the people are in risk, compliance, and legal. And so it's a bit of a hybrid, but unlike, say, a large bank where they don't even talk about software engineers, they talk about IT. You know, the percentage of people in IT, in their words, is probably less than 5%. And the percentage of those that are actually doing consumer software is almost nothing. And so we look really different than the incumbents, certainly. And we expect in 5 years to have a very similar kind of allocation of OPEX. We expect to be about half people involved in product engineering and you know, delivering the service globally.
Jeremy, I'd like to toss out two risk questions for you and get your reaction to them, business risk questions for you. So one business risk involves the integrity and viability of the Bitcoin blockchain, which is the processing platform that, as I understand it, you're basically using. So that seems to me to be a business risk that you're probably thinking about. And the other one, and I say this half in jest, the other business risk is that every country in the world adopts a real-time payment system and they all become interoperable, which would make your solution perhaps irrelevant. As I say that half in jest, but I'd like your reaction to both of those.
Yeah, sure. So just to clarify one thing, which will be, I think, helpful in answering the questions, we only use the Bitcoin blockchain when you're using Circle with another digital wallet. It's the interoperability layer. Mm-hmm. So if you have another digital wallet in Korea or the Philippines or in Japan or China or wherever you are, because we don't operate in those markets, and you want to exchange value from that local currency with someone who's in the U.S. Or Europe or vice versa, that's when we settle the transaction over the Bitcoin blockchain. And but if it's
interesting,
you know,
so you would not use that in the U.S. then for within U.S. Right. transactions.
Any market where we're launched in a regulated capacity and where we have the native currency in our transaction banking system, that all just happens natively off-chain in our own ledger, and that's more like, you know, say the way a Citigroup would operate if you were moving value between accounts across currencies, et cetera. So there's that piece, and then there's the interoperability piece, which is something we're very focused on because we, you know, this is, again, this concept of open protocols for settling transactions over the open internet. That's what we want to see. Now, in that case, yeah, we do have concerns about the viability of the Bitcoin blockchain because there's a cohort of engineers who control the commit access to the code who've been very resistant to introducing features that would make it more mainstream, would make it more compliant, and would allow it to scale with, from a transaction throughput perspective into something that could be really used as a proper settlement network. And so that's a real concern of ours. And so, you know, we think there have to be new public blockchains as well as permission chains that are mapped to existing settlement layers like SWIFT. So there's a lot of movement that's going to happen there, I think, in the relatively near future. And by no means do we think that sort of innovation is done in this space. If anything, innovation in the public blockchain space has really been stifled because of a lack of a desire for mainstream use cases on the technology. And that's a concern of ours, certainly. But it doesn't really materially affect our operations today. Now, I do think, though, in the long run, I mean, one of the things we've invested in is relationships with central banks and educating them and also working with those central banks who are taking a pretty forward-looking view on this. So the Bank of England, as well as the People's Bank of China, we spent considerable time with both. And, you know, they're moving ahead with, a digital currency model, so cryptographic tokens with auditable blockchain-based record-keeping models, but on a permissioned basis, membership network, similar to other clearing networks, but using that architecture and actually using crypto tokens. And that's really powerful, and we thought several years ago that eventually, you know, the G8 currencies would move to crypto and that you'd have, you know, domestic membership networks, you'd have international membership networks, and you'd get the benefits of that technology. Our view was that it's more likely that that's going to come from technical innovation by consumer internet companies that are driving this forward than from governments planning it over 10 years. And so I think it may be a little of both. I mean, like the Chinese government, when they decide to do something, they do it and they get the best engineers in the world to work on it and they launch it, whether it's building a dam or building a telescope or building trains or whatever it is. So China's able to do things like this. I'm not convinced, say, if you put the Federal Reserve in charge of designing something like this, they really need industry to be much more involved because just the way that government works here in the U.S.
Let me switch gears just a bit. I want to get to the consumer piece of this.
Yeah, great.
How are you getting consumers on board? I think about, you know, the P2P, which I know is just an example of your use, one use case, but it's very difficult to get the ubiquity of P2P and get that flywheel going. How are you doing it?
Yeah. So the interesting thing about social payments and P2P, we use social payments in part because we've had a big focus on combining payments with the broader set of social messaging experiences that we have. It's not just, hey, I have a person I need to address a payment to. It's I'm interacting with a person or a group of people, and I'm doing that with social messaging, with the expressiveness of that and that user experience. So we feel like it's a category that makes sense to a big chunk of consumers that use, you know, messaging apps and social messaging. Our view is severalfold. So one is, in the West, this category is not that large today. Even the sort of leading product in the U.S., Venmo, the total, you know, process volume sounds pretty big, but when you look at the total volume of P2P transactions that happen or that are estimated to happen, it's tiny. And certainly, if you look at active users, in China, there's over 500 million active users of P2P and social payments. I mean, that's staggering. It might be single-digit millions in the U.S. It might be single-digit millions. and it's virtually nothing in Europe. There are bank transfers. People do bank transfers. That's and that is a form of P2P payment. But this user experience of social payments that's seamlessly integrated into these core consumer apps that people use, that's a new thing. So our view is that it's still the early days of this. Our focus is, you know, like a lot of consumer internet companies, is just learning from the data, iterating every week, continually improving the product. The beautiful thing about a social payment app is it does have built-in network effects, because it becomes more useful the more people who use it. And if you create a delightful experience on each end of that, and you can keep reducing the friction and keep creating the incentive for people to do that, it has its own network effect. So one is just focusing on what we can do in the product to just drive that behavior, and looking at the virality and iterating with growth experiments and just doing that week over week. And that's been really helpful. We've seen in the U.S. and Europe in the last 12 months, I think almost 500% growth in payment volume. And, you know, some of that is driven by marketing investments, but a lot of that, the vast majority, is actually from organic ongoing usage. The other is we do focus on marketing. So about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, we started to invest in marketing once we had a product that we knew had day-to-day utility value for people. And so we do digital marketing that covers a variety of channels, campus and kind of college marketing programs. We do, brand affinity kind of partnerships with brands that reach target segments and use cases that we care about. So in the UK, for example, this huge thing with these sort of informal soccer leagues, and it's just mm-hmm. a big pain for people to collect dues, and then they go out for pints afterwards, and they're sharing expenses. And, you know, we commissioned research in the U.S. and U.K. about how much people actually owe each other, how much they actually realize that they pay for people but never get paid back. And it's pretty staggering. So we've done PR and other things. So we try to build awareness, and we use digital marketing tactics to do a lot of that. And then we just try and drive and iterate in product to keep making it better and better. The other thing is, and you touched on this earlier, is, you know, we really want Circle as a service to be synonymous with I can pay anyone anywhere. And that also means putting Circle inside of existing messaging containers. And so we launched Circle for iMessage a month and a half ago. It's a really nice experience. For me to receive a text from someone who I know and who I trust from their mobile with a little money card and a nice message and just tap it and have a kind of really simple experience, that's a really good onboarding experience for someone who hasn't done this kind of social payment before or who's mm-hmm. only ever thought of writing a check. And so creating those on-ramps and user experiences that delight people is a big part of what we do to keep driving usage.
Karen owes me $20, but I've pretty much given up on ever getting it back. I wish I had the solution.
So you need the delightful experience of Circle. Maybe I pay attention.
Seriously, can I ask one question, Karen, to Jeremy,
yes,
which is, are you trying to focus at all, Jeremy, on particular narrowly defined use cases or on particular corridors? Is there a focus on how you're trying to roll this thing out?
Yeah. So maybe the best way to think about it is, you know, at a high level, in 5 years, we don't think there'll be a concept of a cross-border payment or a remittance mm-hmm. that we for consumers at least. We don't think that concept will exist any more than there's cross-border email or international web browsing sessions, right?
Mm-hmm.
The internet doesn't
mm-hmm.
work that way. The expectations are that it just works, and it's this sort of seamless, instant thing. So we think that we're headed there. We also think as a result, though, that the cost, essentially the spread on what the global banks pay each other for currency will kind of collapse to zero for consumers. In the same way that, you know, I can do a peer-to-peer voice call or video call for free today over the internet, and yes, there's data charges at some level, but they're so low that the open protocols can make that work really cheaply. So we think something similar happens there. So what we don't want to do is sort of position as we're an international money transfer thing with corridors, which is sort of the old world model. We're just we're a global social payment service, and that means it works the same way whether you're in the same currency or not. And if you use the product across currencies, say euro to sterling or euro to dollar, it's a really seamless experience. And so we do want to market that. So we want to first drive use cases that are around just eliminating the cash and checks problem in personal payments and doing that in a way that works with any bank account in the U.S. or Europe. Secondly, because we're, in a sense, commoditizing FX for consumers, we want to shed some light on that, and we want to find the people where that's important and where they can drive adoption. And I think they'll like the fact that they can use it for not just those kind of payments with family, friends, colleagues, but also with their family, friends, colleagues that are in the same place that they live. And those are, you know, those are the focuses. You will see us turning on more currencies and markets because we want this to work globally. And not all of those are going to be through Circle launching a subsidiary like we've done in China, but some of those are going to be done by taking advantage of open blockchain protocols so that if there are credible digital wallet services in Korea or Japan or the Philippines or other markets or Brazil or India, that we can take advantage of blockchain tech to provide a seamless experience between those platforms. Similar to how, you know, I don't care what carrier you have or what messaging app you use, my SMS gets there. Similarly, we want things to work that way for digital wallet users. So you'll see us, you know, bringing on more markets and currencies through those kinds of models, as well as expanding ourselves natively. So we opened Circle China in January of this year and are hopefully going to be able to have a product that is available, you know, in 2017 and make it possible for consumers in China to exchange RMB between the U.S. and Europe in a seamless way as well.
So let me ask a question in closing. You mentioned, you know, in 5 years there won't be this concept of cross-border payments or corridors with respect to remittances. So what will it be in 5 years if you have your way, and in 15 years, and who will be left standing or who won't be left standing as a result of what you're building?
Yeah. So I think that the, you know, for us, like, our vision doesn't end just with social payments. We definitely want to build out a broader suite of consumer products, financial products. But social payments is a starting point for us. Open global social payments is a starting point for us. What I would imagine is in 5 years that you've got, you know, regional, very significant regional companies as well as very significant global companies. Some of those will be new consumer internet companies that grew up in the next 5 years. Some of those will be established internet companies. Some of these will be established global banks who are operating with a similar model, with this sort of open protocols that make these kinds of experiences more seamless and that are integrated with how we interact with people already through messaging and the like. But we're interested in really reconceptualizing what a spending account is and how what the user experience is for the value that people store with the spending account. So eventually we want to figure out ways for people to pay businesses as well. Right now that's not a focus for us. I think over the real long term, I mean, I think the question is, you know, is financial technology, are technology companies going to be, you know, the significant financial services companies of the future? And there's a pretty good argument to say that that will be the case, and that mm-hmm. some of the large established players that are established financial industry players will become more like technology companies as well. It's not a zero-sum game in our view. But I think that, you know, the companies that are really driven by software and technology and consumer and that can get the benefits of scale and efficiency that come from that can do a really good job and kind of help create a new experience for people for what banking might be, you know, possible.
And so where are banks in your world?
I think that there will be lots of banks. You know, there's a social, economic, and kind of institutional role that these kinds of institutions play, and it's part of a bargain that society makes to have, you know, trusted intermediaries that keep people's money protected and safe and that try and limit what criminals can do in society, and that's an important institution. What we charter those as, or what the name of the charter is, or is it a bank, or is it some other thing that you call it, I don't know the answer to that, but clearly there will be government-regulated intermediaries that interact with all this technology and data and so forth. And we're open to anything. You know, we've been one of the companies advocating for a, you know, limited purpose fintech bank charter with the OCC.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think there'll be lots of banks, and I think there'll be a lot of new kinds of companies that are bank-like, and there'll be a lot of existing banks that continue on and build more and more software-driven products.
Interesting, fascinating conversation, Jeremy. Thank you. David, any final thoughts before we let Jeremy go?
No, I'd like to talk for about another hour. This has really been fascinating, really interesting business, and sounds like a great opportunity, although difficult, of course.
It is hard. It's the hardest business I've ever worked on, for sure. But that's you know, sort of what got us excited in the first place.
It's amazing. So Jeremy and Sean are some of the starring actors, as are you, David, in the Payology course that we have on payments.com that we collaborated with Visa. And I remember Sean saying that it's the only piece of software he's ever had to develop where he needed 25 people to say yes. They weren't necessarily the 25 people sitting around the conference table at Circle. So it's definitely a complicated endeavor, but yet a very exciting opportunity. Jeremy, thanks for your time today. We really appreciate
it. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Thank you. And everyone, have a great rest of the day, and don't forget to vote. And we'll see you next time. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.